news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe, taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back as we begin another week in pursuit of the anomalous. Unidentified anomalous phenomena and other mysteries of space-time and the cosmos, all of which we explore here every week. Listen on demand via podcasting apps all throughout space and time. And of course, via our station affiliates over at the UnX Radio Network. Good evening, good morning, or good afternoon, wherever you may be. I hope you're all good out there, wherever in space-time you find yourselves. We've had a lot happening in the news these days. Mystery booms shaking things up further south. An Apollo 11 mystery that we may have some new information about. Although something else mysterious in orbit, observed by the U.S. Space Force in recent days, well, it remains a mystery, but I'll tell you what we've learned about that, and also what a number of academics have said in recent days with regard to a new UAP study that was just published, hot off the press, in fact. And of course, the ever ongoing controversies of those in the know who are out there. And yes, I'm speaking about Gary Nolan, who was a guest here on the program in recent days. He made some controversial statements over the weekend. We'll be analyzing some of those and also revisiting some of what he and I talked about when he joined us here on the program. But speaking of those with knowledge of the government and its dealings with UAP, later in the program this week, we're also going to be joined by Colm Kelleher, the former deputy director of the Advanced Aerospace Weapons Systems Application Program, otherwise known as ALSAP, that operated for a time out of the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and of course, the exploits of which were documented in the book Skinwalkers at the Pentagon. Yes, indeed. I've got quite a lot on my mind that I want to ask Dr. Kelleher about, so let's get right into things. You know, I'll mention that in recent days, we published an excellent article there at the Debrief by Dr. Michael Glosson. He's a friend of the program and a gentleman I've enjoyed talking with over the last couple of years. He's based down there in Charleston, South Carolina. But as a professor of philosophy, he recently penned a really intriguing article that's really been raising some eyebrows out there. He wrote this for us over at thedebrief.org, and this looks at some of the common assumptions that we have about UFOs and why, in his opinion, those need to change, although I happen to share his opinion. In fact, I'm just glad to see more professors of philosophy getting into the game and weighing in on the UAP topic. We need a little more of that. There are some, you know, who say that philosophy is dead. That's a thing of the past. Yes, we rely on good hard science these days, folks, not philosophy, and the seemingly nonsensical asking of questions about questions. Again, I differ on that point. I've expressed that opinion for a long time on this show. Philosophers of science really kind of provide a lot of very important guidance to scientists. And while I think that's applicable to a lot of different areas of science, really, I think that we need more of that when it comes to UAP. So thanks to Michael Glosson for weighing in on the subject. Who knows, perhaps we'll have him on the show in the days ahead. And he's close enough, in fact, that we could almost just link up someplace nearby and record that conversation. Being down in Charleston, South Carolina, as he is, a whole lot of friends of the program down in Charleston, South Carolina. In fact, Jason Pintrail, longtime co-host of the Seven Ages Audio Journal, and one of my archaeology buddies, and of course also Jay Waller, who Jason and I met at a little event we did down there, a listener meetup down in Charleston. But Jay, being a part of our greater network of news informants all throughout the globe, as he is, Jay sent along a story that really caught my attention, and if you live in the Charleston area like he does, perhaps it caught your attention as well, since many are reporting that they heard a loud mystery boom early this morning. That's right, according to the article that Jay sent me here, it notes that people living and working along the Lowcountry coast to those living as far inland as Monk's Corner contacted News 2 regarding what many said sounded like an explosion followed by a quick shaking that occurred shortly before 9 a.m. Now, apparently, the United States Geological Survey said that currently, based on data they have, there's no indication this was an earthquake. So the next thing, I guess, that comes to mind for me at least is, well, you've got Joint Base Charleston right there. Could it have been a sonic boom? Well, News 2 reached out to Joint Base Charleston, and a spokesperson said it didn't appear to be base-related either. So if it wasn't a sonic boom from aircraft or some sort of an ordnance being detonated, if it wasn't an earthquake, what then was the cause of this mystery boom? They note that officials with the South Carolina Emergency Management Division were also contacted, and they had noted that they were getting several questions about this large boom or rumbling noise in the Charleston area earlier this morning. They said, "We have no reports of any earthquakes at this time. We're working to determine the source." The boom and the rumble, they said, could be heard in several doorbell videos that were also shared. You know, these doorbell cams that people have to monitor what's happening out in front of their home. Well, a lot of these cameras also picked up this mystery boom. And so naturally, I'm wondering how many of our listeners down there in the Charleston, South Carolina area may have heard this. If you or somebody you know heard this mystery boom, consider contacting us here at the Micah Hanks Program, info@MicahHanks.com, or you can tweet at me directly, @MicahHanks. Again, a few more of these descriptions. Out there on James Island, one of my favorite haunts when I'm down there on the coast, one resident said it shook their house. They say that on Daniel Island, all the houses in an entire neighborhood seem to have shook when this boom occurred. There was another witness that provided some interesting information because, in addition to having heard the boom itself, some individuals, according to this source, said they also heard what sounded like a jet engine beforehand, so they actually think it was some kind of military aircraft. So that would seem to be contrary to what Joint Base has said in their official statement. But often, when I've looked into cases like this in the past, they may initially say, if they haven't confirmed anything conclusively, "We have no information for you about that right now," but then the following day they'll come out and say, "Oh, you know what? Actually, we did have aircraft operating right out there off the coast. That's probably the boom you heard." But given that so many of the residents down there along the coast and the little island chains right there in Greater Charleston seem to be the ones primarily that are reporting this, my guess would have to be in this case a sonic boom. Although, keep in mind, they also mentioned that people as far inland as Monk's Corner also were reporting this. So again, if any of you guys down there heard this, if any of you saw military jets, or if you heard a jet engine coinciding with this boom, info@MicahHanks.com, I'd like to hear from you. And if you'd like to hear more about mystery booms, you guys probably know I've been a longtime tracker of this particular variety of phenomenon or phenomena. In reality, there are a lot of different things that can cause loud, mysterious booms, but you can learn about all the different varieties of sources over there at mysterybooms.com, the website I have archived online, which is an information source about this particular phenomena. And thanks to Jay, of course, as always, for being one of our informants down there on the coast, who keeps us up to date on what's happening. In other news, we had this one sent along by a longtime listener, Stephen Walker, good friend of the program also. And this one takes us all the way back to 1969, July 21st, to be specific, when Apollo 11's Eagle lunar ascent stage lifted off from the surface of the moon to rendezvous with the command module Columbia, which at that time was in orbit around it. After docking, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin clambered back into Columbia carrying 22 kilograms of lunar rock. The crew then closed the hatch, and the command module returned to Earth. Well, at that time, of course, Eagle was jettisoned, leaving that ascent module in a retrograde orbit approximately 125 kilometers above the lunar equator. It's always been assumed that this orbit was unstable and that at some time or another, Eagle probably crashed somewhere into the lunar surface, but that really has remained undetermined. But there's new information now. And according to Discover Magazine here, a new analysis says that Eagle may never have landed. Yeah, it may have remained aloft, or in orbit, really, all this time. Essentially in the exact same orbit that Columbia had been in while it was orbiting the moon, and while Aldrin and Armstrong were down there bopping around and collecting regolith and lunar rocks and things during their little adventure on the surface. There exists some possibility, and I'm quoting here, that this machine might have reached an inert state allowing it to remain in orbit to the present day. That according to James Meador, an independent researcher, who thinks that not only might Eagle still be in orbit, but that it actually could be visible from Earth for anybody who really wanted to try and find it. Now, this reminds me of a really interesting anecdote, because Francis Ridge is the gentleman who runs the NICAP.org website, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. Now, that organization, once the largest civilian UFO investigative organization in the country, it's now defunct, but Francis Ridge maintains a website with a lot of resources related to its investigations, and it's really one of my favorite websites about UFOs, just because there's so much data that Ridge has made available on that site. But Ridge is a longtime UFO researcher and space watcher, and he also had an interesting project back in the 1990s called Lunascan. And Lunascan involved a remote unit with a trailer and a very strong telescope hooked up to cameras, and that would allow this thing to be positioned in such ways that it could be oriented so that it could follow the moon and it could observe it in high quality and spot any potential objects that might have been up there encircling the moon. Well, at some point back in the 1990s, I recall Francis Ridge saying that there was an anomalous feature discovered, some sort of an object that appeared to be in orbit around the moon. And he said this was noteworthy because this was prior to us putting the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter up there in orbit. So he wondered what in the world, or in this case, maybe what not of this world, might be up there encircling the moon. I guess at that time we hadn't presumed that Eagle, from the famous 1969 Apollo 11 mission, might have still been in orbit. It was always assumed that it probably crashed into the lunar surface. But if indeed it's still up there, and as Mr. James Meador suggests, this object might indeed still be able to be seen by anyone who was looking for it, my guess is that perhaps it's actually already been spotted. Maybe, just maybe, that was the unusual object that Francis Ridge spotted back in the 1990s, and which he had written about, noting that there shouldn't have been anything, man-made at least, in orbit around the moon at that time, but we saw something. What was it? Could it have been Eagle? At least in terms of following the departure of the NASA astronauts from the Apollo 11 mission, maybe Eagle didn't land after all. Maybe it's still up there, maybe it is detectable, and in fact, maybe somebody has already detected it. I'm going to have to look a little more deeply into this one, but again, that's my speculation. And again, thanks to Stephen for sending that story along to us. We always appreciate those. If anybody wants to share a story with me, you can send those to info@micahanks.com. You can also try my debrief editorial email, micah@thedebrief.org. I know sometimes there are some email deliverability issues with one or the other addresses, but usually one of them will work. And speaking of the debrief, you guys may have actually seen that this morning we had put up an article with an update about something else mysterious that was observed in Earth orbit this time. Yeah, something that was observed by the U.S. Space Force following China's space plane. What was it? Was it a UFO? Actually, in this case, I think it might be a UOO, unidentified orbiting object. But in this case, we do know where it came from. We don't know what the object is exactly. All we really know is that this thing came out of the Chinese space plane that recently returned to Earth after completing its mysterious mission in space. But one thing that is clear is that according to a recent assessment produced by the Center for Strategic and International Studies and its Aerospace Security Project, they say that although it remains in question what exactly the object may have been, we have learned a few things about it. This is what the report states. Few details have surfaced about either vehicle. There were actually two launches, one in low Earth orbit and one that went up a little higher. That one, which was launched in September 2020 by a Long March 2F rocket, apparently remained in orbit for close to 48 hours, and during that time it was observed to have released a secondary object. We've actually got a photograph made available courtesy of the folks at Slingshot Aerospace, and you can see that right there in the debrief article. I think I'm going to leave this one right there for now and let you guys head on over there, take a look at the article, let me know what you think it is. Yeah, we still don't know exactly what the object was. One thing, though, that we do know about it is that the object does seem to have been capable of transmitting signals, right? The actual wording in the document, in the ASP report, is that the object released by the Chinese space plane was, quote, capable of broadcasting transmissions. So what do you guys think that object was? I'd be interested in getting your thoughts, and if you'd like to get a few more of mine, head on over to thedebrief.org. You can check out the article, and of course, I'll have that linked in the show notes for you so it's easy to access from right there in your podcasting app. But while you're there at The Debrief, you may also want to check out Chris Plain's recent article about the academics who responded to a recent UAP survey. Yeah, this one that Chris dropped for us Monday night notes that 13% of academics who responded to a research team's survey recently say that they believe unidentified aerial phenomena could represent devices of unknown intelligence. Fascinating. 19% of those same respondents, they say, said they or someone they know has witnessed a UAP. And a further 37% also revealed an interest in conducting further research into UAP. As Chris tells us, notably, 96% of the academics who were sent the survey didn't reply at all. So what does that actually say? You know, we have felt for the last few years that we've been reaching this kind of glass ceiling moment with UAP, and especially the way that academics are engaging with this, as evidenced, of course, by the likes of Michael Glosson and other academics who have written about this topic or commented on it in our commentaries over there at thedebrief.org. 96% of academics, though, who were sent this survey didn't even reply, which, as Chris notes, may indicate a potential bias against the topic in general, one that seems to have been maintained for quite a long time. Is that disheartening? Well, I can tell you this. Even if most academics are still somewhat weary of engaging with this topic and dialogue about it, or admitting that they've seen these things, or that they may think that these things are devices of unknown intelligence, there's one gentleman in recent days who has made quite a bit of news and stirred up quite a bit of controversy for espousing his opinions on that. That's right, it is Gary Nolan. We will look at what he had to say in recent days when we return here in a moment on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. Continuing our discussion about unidentified anomalous phenomena and what scientists have to say about it. Yeah, again, Chris Plain's article there at The Debrief, I'll have that linked in the show notes, but 96% of academics didn't even reply to a survey about this, according to a recent survey that's been conducted. In fact, the folks who were behind the study in question, we may reach out to them, try to get them here on the program at some point in the days ahead. But of those 13% who did respond, yeah, some were willing to admit they think some UAP could represent devices of unknown intelligence. Not just unknown origin, but unknown intelligence, and that we need to be studying them. I share that sentiment, obviously. In fact, I'm about to launch some new UAP investigative and analytic efforts. I won't say too much about this just yet. It's still very much in the works and therefore under wraps, but trust me, when it's ready to launch, you're going to know all about it. And I hope it'll be something that may be useful in furthering our knowledge about this, because there is a whole lot of debating and fighting and criticizing and accusing. You know, truly, I attempt to be balanced on my programs. I try never just to seem like I am pro-UAP all the time. If anything, I'm too skeptical for a lot of people. Except for a few of the skeptics out there. Although there are some I keep in touch with who say that they feel like I'm maybe more balanced, or at least attempt to be, more so than most commentators on the UAP topic. Mick West appears to have conveyed those sentiments to me, both on social media, even while, at times, taking issue with some of my own opinions. And there have been others too. Again, it's important, I think, to see both sides of the argument. But in most instances, it's either you're all in on UAP and everything, therefore, is potential evidence of extraterrestrial existence and its visitation to Earth. Or on the other hand, the other extreme, it seems implausible, therefore it's probably impossible, therefore I'll lead with that presumption and I will attack every such claim that seems to look at those possibilities. You know, I'm interested in both sides of the argument, but nonetheless, I would have to imagine that with all of the claims that have been collected over the decades, at least since the Cold War, with relation to UAP, and again, I'm not trying to limit the data set only to modern history, I'm a proponent of the idea that this phenomenon probably goes much further back, but I also happen to be of the mind that the best data probably has been collected since the Cold War, and in fact, some of the best data on UAP, if only the public could see it, that of course which remains in government holdings, that all may have been collected within just the last few years. Perhaps time will tell. But in any case, I'd have to think that all of that data should be indicative of something, and if it were truly only mundane things, you'd think we'd have figured that out by now. And yet it doesn't seem that we have. Again, the comments made by Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick of Arrow are often, rather than being taken as definitive of this or that, they're really more tantamount to a Rorschach test. Skeptics hear what they want to hear, believers hear what they want to hear. Everybody has their own level of interpretation that they project onto it. So what's really going on? Now, for Gary Nolan's part, he says he thinks he does know what's going on because in recent days he made some rather controversial statements during a public event. I want to go to the audio here now. This was from a recent SALT conference that was held up there in New York, a portion of which was titled The Pentagon Extraterrestrial Intelligence and Crashed UFOs. Yeah, Alex Klokas here with the SALT organization moderating. Really, it's not moderating so much as he is simply asking questions of Gary Nolan, who joins him on stage. We're going to go to the audio now here, where Klokas asks Gary what his feelings are about UAP, what it might represent, what it all means. Here's what Gary had to say.
I'm curious, do you believe that extraterrestrial intelligence has visited planet Earth?
I think you can go a step further. It hasn't just visited, it's been here a long time, and it's still here. And it has people talk about the wow signal, looking for extraterrestrial intelligence. The wow signal is that people see it on an almost regular basis. That's the communication that's already here.
And that statement seems so incredible that it's tough to believe, right? Like, people hear that, and maybe a lot of people here hear that, and they don't believe it. And so I'm curious, if you had to assign a probability to that statement, that you believe extraterrestrial intelligence has visited this planet, what probability would you assign?
100%.
Wow. Now you can imagine, of course, what the response online had been to Gary's statement there, and there's a whole lot more of that audio. Fortunately, we have that embedded courtesy of Project Unity in a tweet, and I'll have that tweet linked in the show notes so you can watch the entire 16, almost 17 minute clip of Gary Nolan talking about this there with Mr. Klokas at the SALT iConnections conference in New York last week. But what are we to make of that? You know, a lot of people hear this and they say, well, Gary Nolan, respected scientist as he is, saying rather definitively that he thinks, 100% likelihood that ET, not just some sort of phenomena, some sort of intelligence. No, he says extraterrestrials have visited Earth. They're still here. 100% likelihood. He sounds pretty certain. You know, to me, I think fundamentally the first thing we need to remember is that although I know many of us may be inclined to agree with Gary's statement, that is primarily Gary's opinion, although he actually goes on to say right there, following where we left off with the audio, that it's not just his opinion, and he of course cites a lot of data that he believes supports that opinion. I do think that fundamentally what Gary is saying there is similar to the argument I made a few minutes ago, that with all this information we've been collecting since at least the late 1940s, even if you go no further back then, the development of radar, the atomic bomb, the end of the Second World War, and the beginning of modern history, when really the UFO phenomenon as we know it today formally begins, right? You'd have to think that this data that we've been collecting, all this information about sightings of objects in the sky, and sometimes even stranger things than that, that people have been coming forward over the years and talking about, you'd have to think that some of that represents something. Gary Nolan certainly seems to think so. But of course, the challenges online were issued immediately. Mick West, who I also mentioned earlier, of course, was quick to point out, you know, Gary says these things, but what happens if in 10 years, none of these big developments involving whistleblowers and Congress and the Ultimate Anomaly Resolution Office and its quest to try and interview people with knowledge of the inner workings in government and its secret holdings regarding UAP information, what if nothing really comes to fruition with all this? Well, what if? In my view, we keep looking, right? But a lot of people seem to want it now. Actually, they don't want it now, they want it yesterday. There seem to have also been a lot of people who have recently come to the UAP topic, and they expected, around 2017, that disclosure was imminent. Never paid attention to UFOs before, but all of a sudden, now that it's cool, and it's on the front page of the New York Times, and there's a government program, and there are videos being leaked, folks, this must be it. There really is a there. Now we can all jump on board, and if we apply enough pressure, disclosure will be imminent. But when it wasn't imminent, when it didn't all come spilling forth for various reasons, I'll leave that to your imaginations, dear listeners. But again, when that didn't all come spilling forward, a lot of people became disenfranchised. A lot of people who were initially weighing in with commentary on the topic from a pro-UAP standpoint seemed to have switched sides. They all of a sudden start batting for the other team. To me, really, that has less to do with being skeptical or growing to a point of skepticism. It really seems to have to do with being impatient and suddenly feeling disenfranchised for having gone out on a limb and then being felt like they were left dangling. And so then the effect is a reflexive reversion back to skepticism, and they posture themselves from a position where they can attack both the subject, but more importantly, those who appear to still be proponents of the subject that they feel has let them down. For my own part, it really seems like I've seen a lot of that in recent days. But again, for those who've followed my work for more than a decade, you know, I've been with this for a long time. I'm not exactly a newcomer to the topic like many people who have arrived since 2017 and have already jumped ship or maybe switched sides seem to have done. No, I already was prepared for the idea that nothing really comes as quickly as people hope that it will when it comes to this topic. And so naturally, with regard to Dr. Nolan's statements there, you know, many of them somewhat reflecting similar themes that he and I discussed a few weeks back, I do wonder sometimes, is Gary even perhaps getting to a point where he is now more hopeful of what's about to happen? Looking at statements like those that Gary shared at the SALT conference last week, again, it really does seem to give one the feeling that something's about to happen. But really, and maybe on this side of the coin, I'm a little more with the skeptics, but we hear that so often. Folks, just wait. Something's about to happen. It's coming. It's right around the corner. Disclosure, something big's going to happen. I mean, there have been some big names. I'm actually not talking about Gary Nolan, per se. There are other big names who've been making statements like this now for quite some time. And we're still sort of waiting. You know, what's coming? What's going to happen? We were told this or that might happen, and it hasn't happened yet. You know, to an extent, I can see why some people start feeling disenfranchised and why they start really becoming more and more cynical, and that cynicism gives rise maybe to skepticism. Yeah, because they do feel like they've had to wait a long time. Again, what I'm trying to convey here, though, is that waiting is a part of this process, if the history of UAP studies is any indication. And so maybe I wouldn't be so quick to hold my breath and hope that the big change, the huge news, the grand disclosure is right around the corner. But in truth, fundamentally, coming back to Gary Nolan and his statements from last week, really what Gary was saying and addressing primarily was that he thinks not only that UAP, some of them, do unequivocally represent extraterrestrial intelligence, but he thinks that it's been here for a long time, it's here right now, and that there is some evidence that supports that. On that note, Let's jump back into this audio for just a moment, where he offers a bit of his rationale for why he holds that belief.
And that's not just my opinion. I mean, look, the National Defense Appropriation Act, passed last year, signed by Biden in December. 30 pages of that is the establishment of an unidentified aerial phenomenon office, the establishment of looking into the harm that's happened to an even number of the individuals, going back to 1945 and looking at the disinformation and misinformation that has been basically articulated over the decades. 12 U.S. senators have signed on to a document that basically says we want the information. The establishment of an office, ARROW, in the Department of Defense has 25 people working in it right now. And what's their goal? Collecting the information across all of the U.S. Department of Intelligence, Department of Defense intelligence offices, and collation of that into a uniform format for the very first time, and provision of that then to Congress. The creation of a whistleblowers program specifically that allows people from within, who, I'm going to say this, who've been working on the reverse engineering programs, reverse engineering of objects, so that they can come in and break their oaths, but specifically just to talk to Congress and give that information in classified settings. And that the most recent one that happened was just last weekend, and it created quite a hornet's nest in Washington.
So those are some of the finer points behind Gary's contention about what's been happening. And fundamentally, it's similar to what I had outlined earlier, in the sense that if you go all the way back to the 1940s, and you look at the amount of data that has accumulated about this topic over time, there would have to be a there. But, again, the other side of the coin for me also has to do with what is the most reliable information that we currently have. I've been catching some whispers about some of the whistleblower stuff going on in Washington right now, and it seems to be very much a double-edged sword. There's always the possibility that some really good information is going to come out. But some of the stories I'm also hearing from some of those that I'm in contact with who are in the know, it's a little less than convincing to me. And so it's yet to be seen really whether there's going to be a huge shift that results from all this, right? But fundamentally, I do agree with Gary that if we go all the way back to the 1940s and we look at all the sum total of data that's been collected, I may not point for point agree always with Gary on every aspect of everything that's happened since 1945 up to the present day that many view as being formative in the history of ufology. Some of those elements are more credible, more reliable data, more important in furthering our understanding about the phenomenon than others. But fundamentally, the argument remains there's an awful lot of data. It should account for something. And recent events like the formation of ARROW, the passage of the Gillibrand Amendment, and the NDAA for fiscal year 2022, all these things seem to point to the fact that government also is taking this seriously, even if a lot of what, for instance, ARROW and Dr. Kirkpatrick are currently looking at involves national security challenges that could represent earthly technologies, Chinese drones, Russian technologies, what have you. And hence why I think a lot of people are disenfranchised about ARROW, but I say yet again, give it some time, just don't hold your breath, it probably won't be tomorrow. But indeed, given enough time, the All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office could indeed present some fascinating results. We'll just have to wait and see. But also keep in mind that ARROW is not the first iteration of a UAP investigative group within the Pentagon in recent years. No, there was another one called OSAP, and one of the key figures behind the operations of that program, Dr. Colm Kelleher, will be joining us when we come back here in just a moment on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. The Advanced Aerospace Weapons Systems Application Program, or AWSAP, still remains rather enigmatic for many, including myself. And so I'm eager to get into this conversation with Dr. Colm A. Kelleher here in just a moment. First, of course, I do want to remind you, if you are not already a subscriber to the X podcasts, which go out every week, along with monthly specials, it's easy to sign up. I've got a link right there in the show notes for you, and you can access that from your podcasting app or just head on over to MicahHanks.com/X. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year. That'll give you 1 month free, and it gets you complete access to your own RSS feed that has this program ad-free, and of course also the X podcasts every week and the monthly Enigmas specials, all delivered to your smartphone podcasting app of choice. So definitely consider signing up and getting an even deeper look at some of my work. And of course, each week when we have guests or commentary about historic deep dives and investigations of the anomalous, there's always some additional content that we feature there in the weekly X podcast for subscribers. So definitely check that out. But right now, it's time for us to dive into this conversation with a gentleman I've wanted to talk to for a long time. Colm A. Kelleher, PhD, is a biochemist whose career has been in cell and molecular biology. With a PhD in biochemistry from the University of Dublin, Trinity College, he has worked at the Ontario Cancer Institute and several other facilities. Between 1996 and 2004, Kelleher led the National Institute for Discovery Science, or NIDS, team on Skinwalker Ranch. And in 2008, he became Deputy Administrator of Bigelow Aerospace Advanced Space Studies, where he led the day-to-day operations in executing the AWSAP contract with the Defense Intelligence Agency. So, needless to say, this is going to be quite a conversation, and without further ado, welcome to the program, Dr. Kelleher.
Very good to be here.
Yes, indeed. It's very good to have you here. You know, you've been a busy gentleman over the last several decades, and I think really the best place to begin would simply be to ask you, with regard to your professional background, how did that bring you into the study of the anomalous and the introduction to Robert Bigelow and then eventually the work out there on the Utah property?
Well, it actually was one of these happy accidents, if you want to use that term, because as you mentioned, I was in various research institutes around both Canada and the United States, but I was working as a research immunologist at the National Jewish Center in Denver when I looked at an ad in Science magazine, which is probably the premier, Science and Nature, the two premier magazines in the world scientifically. So I was looking at jobs, just browsing, and normally they have jobs for assistant professors in sort of molecular biology, postdoctoral fellowships in immunology, this kind of thing. But this ad caught my eye because it was so bizarre and so weird. It said, "We're looking for scientists that are willing to research the origin and evolution of consciousness in the universe." And I kind of, this was a half page ad, which is pretty expensive. And so I looked at it and said, wow, I've never seen an ad like that in Science magazine. So, you know, I picked up the phone, talked to a couple of people, eventually talked with Robert Bigelow, who invited me out to Las Vegas, Nevada for an interview. And this was in, the interview was July 1996. So around that same time, unbeknownst to me, Robert Bigelow was in the process or beginning the process of buying Skinwalker Ranch. And so he hired me, long story short, he hired me. And so I began work in about August 1996. Within a few weeks of starting work, myself and a physicist and a veterinarian, and there were a couple of other, you know, helping hands, we're on Skinwalker Ranch within a few weeks of me being hired. So it was kind of like that ad in Science magazine made my career as a mainstream immunologist take a hard right turn. And it was just like I have been an experimental biologist all of my life, or all of my research life. And so being on a property with the reputation, sort of the beginnings of a reputation in northeastern Utah, 500 acres, was a completely new experience for me. I knew how to set up controlled experiments, but I wasn't quite prepared to get involved in hunting whatever was on this property.
And that seems to be the question that still remains as well, whatever is on this property. And I know that initially with the NIDS team and then later with OSAP, you were engaged in a variety of different approaches toward trying to resolve exactly what's happening there. So much of which, by the way, is documented well in books you have co-authored with George Knapp and more recently James Lukatsky, who you worked alongside with there for the OSAP effort. First, what were those hypotheses as a scientist, Cullum, that you introduced toward trying to understand, you know, really the range, the diverse array of phenomena occurring there at the Utah property?
Well, obviously, one of the first hypotheses was that fraud by the people who were on the property before we purchased the property. And it was, as luck would have it, we were fortunate to have the guy who used to own the property stay on as ranch manager during this transition period. And he actually ended up staying on for a couple of years. So it was very useful to pick his brains over time. But, you know, within a few weeks of starting on the property, the individuals at NIDS began to see phenomena that were very difficult to explain. And so the whole hypothesis of fraud became not as, not as up front and center as we thought it would be. But we still went through the process of checking these people out. We looked into their backgrounds. We looked into a lot of what they were saying and tried to collate it with, for example, interviewing previous owners on the property, interviewing people around Skinwalker Ranch with regard to seeing if there was any way of corroborating. And it turned out there was a lot of ways of corroborating. So again, the fraud hypothesis started receding. Then sort of hallucination hypothesis, we tested wind direction to see if any of these, you know, spores might be blowing onto the property. One of the rules of thumb that we used right off the get-go was that we drank only bottled water that we brought with us. So we were pretty sure that the water was not contaminated by any hallucinogens. We also investigated, there was a guy called John Durr from the USGS who had a seismic hypothesis. In other words, that seismic activity may give rise to variations of ball lightning. And so we actually tested that by looking at the database of both USGS and also University of Utah and going back within sort of 200 to 300 kilometer radius of the ranch. We mapped out every single, seismic event that had happened above, 2.5 on the Richter scale, essentially. And we mapped that against the times and locations of all of the events that had been documented to date. And, you know, there was no correlation whatsoever. So we went through these kinds of hypotheses slowly. And, you know, it's very difficult to rule something out absolutely. So we definitely kept a lot of that in mind. Another hypothesis is that there were sort of maybe contractors or military, sort of small military units that were using the Uinta Basin as, you know, practice grounds. But, you know, over the entire time of certainly the National Institute for Discovery Science, we talked to people in the neighborhood. We talked to anybody who had been on the property, and we never found any evidence, but we were not able to rule it out in terms of the hypothesis that, you know, some sort of a playground for, you know, testing advanced technology or testing ways of getting onto the property without being seen. It was a hypothesis always in the back of our minds, and we were never able to rule it out. But as time went on and more people were experiencing divergent phenomena, I think we reached a stage where it was difficult to pin that hypothesis on all of the, the panoply of events that we had seen. Everything from cattle mutilations to these small orbs of light, discarnate voices, people on the property had telepathic transmissions from, discarnate voices. A lot of these poltergeist kind of phenomena were fairly common. And then there were, significant numbers of sightings of what looked like, bona fide metallic craft, the so-called classic UFOs. So they were all of these phenomena were overlaid with the so-called paranormal effects, the poltergeist effects, same time, same location. So the big question in our minds always was, are these connected, or do they just happen to be separate phenomena that are co-locating at the same time? And we were never able to fully rule out whether or not they were connected or they were separate phenomena.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, to have such a diverse range of different occurrences all fundamentally occurring, if not at the same time, within close proximity to one another and in a geographically constrained area. I spoke with Eric Davis briefly last year at an event that he and I both attended, and we spoke about those orbs that are described in the first book you and George Knapp co-authored, Hunt for the Skinwalker. And Eric said, they behaved as though they were intelligent. They were intelligently controlled. Do you think that's a fair characterization of the behavior of those objects?
Yeah, I mean, we all saw them, and they did seem to be able to negotiate around. I mean, there was an area on Skinwalker Ranch known as Homestead 2, which was a 1920s era homestead that had been long abandoned. It was about 100 years old. But for some reason, a lot of these objects seemed to fly around this building. And, I personally witnessed that. It seemed to be able to avoid the walls of the building and go around the building. There was a lot of other people who saw these things maneuvering between the branches of a tree, for example, or, the rancher who used to own the property had talked to us about it was interacting with animals while he saw it, specifically dogs. And they were easily able to avoid dogs sort of trying to get at them as they flew low to the ground. So, yeah, I think the sum of all of the events and all of the observations, we definitely surmised that these things were under some kind of intelligent control.
Just a brief tangent to that, in recent days with the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, we had the Senate hearing where Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick actually showed a piece of footage that appeared to show an orb-like spherical object flying over the Middle East. There was a similar photograph of one obtained over Mosul, Iraq, in recent days. Would it be a stretch to say that those are similar, perhaps, in appearance and behavior to some of the orb-like phenomena observed out there at Skinwalker Ranch?
I guess I have not seen any information from either the Mosul, Iraq object or the second object that Dr. Kirkpatrick showed to indicate size of these objects. I know that the objects that we were routinely seeing on Skinwalker Ranch were sort of anything from the size of a softball to a basketball, but I don't know what the distance was between this Reaper drone that was taking these taking the video footage. I don't know what the size was, but certainly the shape was similar. We mostly saw these things at night also. This was a daylight. I know the Middle Eastern one that Dr. Kirkpatrick showed was a daylight object that looked like it was a metallic, or it looked like it was reflecting light. The objects we saw on Skinwalker Ranch were emanating light. They didn't seem to be reflecting light. They seemed to be emanating light. But, you know, if those drones had picked up footage during nighttime, who knows what they would look like.
Yeah, it's interesting. And again, you know, we haven't really got enough information to draw those conclusive, parallels. But again, the general shape dynamics and other kind of behaviors seem to be a fairly good fit. Now, moving forward to the years of OSAP, you know, this broke wide open back around 2017 with reporting first by the New York Times, eventually a book that you co-authored with the former head of the project and, of course, veteran journalist George Knapp. Colin, what would you say the primary differences were between the original NIDS effort at Skinwalker and then the investigative approach of Bigelow Advanced Aerospace Studies under OSAP?
The approaches were, they started off with being fairly similar, and the OSAP program, as you know, was run through the Defense Intelligence Agency. So one of the first things DIA did was they dispatched a series of people at different times. In total, there were about five people who were, on the property, basically to corroborate these sort of wild stories. They'd all read the book Hunt for the Skinwalker, which had come out in 2005. So this is like 2008 era when the OSAP program came out. So I'd say the main difference in the OSAP program was there was a much bigger concentration of DIA personnel on the property, and also interaction between DIA personnel back on the East Coast and us. But one thing we did notice was, and it was an event that we reported in the book, it was what happened to the five intelligence officers that were on the property. All five of them witnessed events they could not explain. And I would say in several cases, they were very intense events. In fact, looking back, all five of them witnessed and experienced very intense activity that they could not explain on the ranch. But really what distinguished, the DIA personnel from everybody else was that once they got home to their homes in the East Coast, all hell seemed to break loose in their homes on the East Coast. And we coined this term, the hitchhiker effect, for something that apparently or possibly attached to them between the time they were on the property and they went home. And they, their families and their roommates and started experiencing orbs of light. They would wake up at night and have these black shadowy sort of entities over their bed. So that was a very intense series of events. The NIDS personnel in general did not experience anything like the intensity of what these individuals experienced. We did have some very mild sort of activity in all of our homes. Myself, Robert Bigelow, George Knapp. I know that everybody who was on the property experienced something. We interviewed over a dozen security officers who rotated through the property to keep an eye on trespassers and all of that. All of these officers also experienced activity in their own homes. But I guess between the DIA phase of the program versus the National Institute for Discovery Science phase, which was 1996 through 2004, there was really an escalation with the activity that happened with the DIA personnel. Now, we don't have any explanation for that, why that would have happened, but that has been the case.
Very interesting points, Dr. Kelleher. And when we come back here in a moment, we'll have to continue this conversation because having spoken to a few of those former officials who are referenced in Colin Kelleher and George Knapp's book, along with James Lakatsky, skinwalkers at the Pentagon. I still have questions. Perhaps Dr. Kelleher does too, and maybe we can find some answers. We'll get into that here in a moment when we return here on the Micah Hanks Program. Skinwalkers at the Pentagon. Something strange was certainly afoot back between 2008 and 2010, but what exactly was that? Perhaps our guest, Dr. Colm A. Kelleher, can shed some additional light on this. Of course, we've been discussing some of the more contentious material in that book shortly before the break there, where some of these DIA officials who were out there at Skinwalker Ranch claimed that they had had a very unusual series of circumstances. Something that, as we'll go on to discuss a little later, almost began to take on virus-like capacities, almost like a mind virus. But Dr. Kelleher, I mean, this sounds perplexing. And admittedly, I'm perplexed by that. And in part because not only having read the book and read the accounts from these DIA officials, but having actually met and spoken to a couple of them, I'm hyper aware of the fact that in recent days, there's sort of been efforts to make this all sound like nonsense. One of those individuals in particular, I know to be a very, very analytical, intelligent intelligence official. And yet I also find it hard to understand how a person with that background, with that seeming mindset, having spoken to this person at length, would have experiences like that. Does it baffle you at all trying to understand what in the hell was happening there?
Well, I mean, I guess that the point that I would make with respect to these very, very credible individuals, all of whom had TSSCI clearances, a few of them had combat experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they were very, very trusted individuals in the military. And, you know, you go through multiple different really serious background checks in order to get TSSCI clearances. So these people were not psychologically impaired or psychologically damaged because, you know, they would be weeded out pretty quickly. So, you know, we've got 5 out of 5 people, 100% of those people who were on the property, number one, saw activity, and number two, they also had these experiences once they got home. So having sort of, I know there's a tendency to ridicule and to belittle these experiences, but these individuals are very, very trustworthy, and they're trusted with United States highly secure information. So, you know, as I said, it's kind of very difficult to come up with the idea that they are all confabulating and that they're all either hallucinating or they're delusional, because that's simply not the case. And in some cases, you know, I've talked to a couple of them, follow them over time, you know, and these events have been going on for years and in the different households. So it's not a couple of isolated events. So we don't have any real explanation for this sort of outburst of activity as a result of these 5 individuals who are being on the property. But, you know, Robert Bigelow, as you know, sold the property in March of 2016, and Brandon Fugel from Utah took it over. He installed a completely separate team of very skeptical people who had not had any experience on Skinwalker Ranch. They were completely separate from either the NIDS people or the OSAP people. And lo and behold, they started having a lot of activity on the property. And they also started reporting, instances of having stuff erupting in their homes. So, you know, there's an element of corroboration, year after year, personnel, multiple different teams, multiple different personnel involved. So it becomes more and more difficult to dismiss over time when you look at, you know, this whole thing started in 1994, with the ranching family. But actually, you know, if you go back into the Uinta Basin and you talk to people, you talk to the neighbors, which we did, you find that it's been going on for decades. You know, we've talked to people who were aware of stuff happening on Skinwalker Ranch back in the 1970s and even before that, including cattle mutilations, including anomalous phenomena. So, you know, we're really talking about something that's been going on for a long time. And it certainly is not specific to the personnel who are on the property. Whether or not it's specific to the property is another question that we were never able to answer.
To your point, by the way, about, you know, locals outside of Skinwalker Ranch who say that they are aware of phenomena having occurred there. My colleague Chrissy Newton, who you've also spoken with in the past, she and I, we did a good bit of research on the ground on adjacent properties, actually drove up to Skinwalker Ranch. We've been in communication with Brandon. But we interviewed a lot of individuals there in the Uinta Basin. Of course, I'm familiar with the work of Junior Hicks and then, of course, Frank Salisbury. There is a tremendous amount of information, especially with regard to UAP phenomena that seems to have, you know, been occurring there for decades. And I would say in my own experience with regard to UAP, perhaps a little more so than what you would see just anywhere. There does seem to be a sort of concentration to your point. So, Cullum, something that I really found interesting, though, was in Skinwalkers at the Pentagon, how you introduced this idea of an infectious agent model or maybe a social contagion model. I see this almost as an outgrowth of some of those earlier hypotheses from the NIDS years. Could we discuss those ideas as approaches toward understanding what may be happening there?
You know, my background is in virology. One of my backgrounds is in virology. I worked on HIV. I worked on Ebola virus. I worked on a bunch of viruses. So when I saw what was happening to all of the individuals over time, and especially retrospectively, as you're watching this, these events that happened on Skinwalker Ranch and then seem to translate into the homes, one of the first things I thought was of an infectious process where sort of the primary target on Skinwalker Ranch is quote unquote infected and then goes back to his or her home on the East Coast, and then family members start experiencing similar events to what is happening on Skinwalker Ranch. So it's like the primary case, the index case, so to speak, in an infectious disease model would then transmit the infectious agent to people in their family. And we had, you know, we were able to sort of follow that and find that, you know, there were neighbors that also reported unexplained activity around their home. So you could posit that the infectious agent went from the family to neighbors. And we even talked to some of the kids involved with this and found that these kids were not in the habit of talking about this in school for fear of being ridiculed. And so they found that kids in their school were also reporting unusual activity. So, you know, you could posit this sort of transmission effect from that went out through the neighborhood and then also into the school. So, you know, it was behaving exactly as an infectious organism, like a virus, might behave. Yeah, well, I guess the caveat there is that the number of cases were so small in terms of doing a standard epidemiological modeling on this whole process. But as we say in the book, it definitely would be amenable to epidemiological standard methodology in any textbook. And everybody's familiar with this whole process now that we've just come through this COVID epidemic. So, in a future UFO program that may be the next generation beyond AARO, I don't know. But I would hope to see that eventually these kinds of investigations might occur, because the number one sort of, I guess, underlying necessity for doing this would be for the individuals who are part of a new UFO program would be to begin talking to the people involved, the witnesses involved, looking at the effects of UFOs on people. And if you do that sort of strategy, in addition to gathering the technical data on UFO performance, if you run both of those in parallel, it's almost inevitable that eventually when witnesses start trusting you, you'll be able to come up with, some variation of what I'm talking about. Because, I mean, there have been so many cases now. If you look at the sort of mild cases that NIDS were reporting, the more florid cases that OSAP were reporting, and then subsequently 2016 to 2023, where additional cases are happening with the Fugl team, eventually with a new UFO program, I think you could probably get a pretty good cohort of people where you could study it properly. I mean, what exactly is happening mechanistically, obviously, is up in the air. But you know, I think once you establish the parameters, you could start looking at mechanistic, possibilities.
Yeah, and with or without there being an actual contagion or some sort of a virus, I still think that an epidemiological approach is interesting. You're not the first person, in fact, who's even, brought that to my attention. I have a friend, Dr. Thomas Glass, with a background in epidemiology, who has noted similar ideas. And actually, Gary Nolan and I have talked about that a bit, too. So that approach at least seems interesting, Dr. Kelleher. Stepping over for a moment into the more explicitly what appear to be structured UAP, another area of continuity that we saw between NIDS and ALSAP certainly involved these so-called Black Triangle UAP. When Skinwalkers at the Pentagon came out, I was actually a bit surprised to see that there was a chapter about that in that book, knowing the history of NIDS investigation into those. Could you speak to that point a bit and the ubiquitousness of these particular varieties of UAP?
Yeah, I mean, I think the NIDS team did a pretty comprehensive job back in the day of interviewing. I think I'm going from memory, but we probably interviewed and gathered between 130, 150 separate cases of triangular phenomena, of triangular craft phenomena that were in the United States in the 1990s, the 2000s. And even the 1980s. So we had a very substantial database under our belt when we, and these all had the same sort of characteristics: very low flying, treetop level, not sort of 3,000 or 4,000 feet. These were very low, usually brightly lit, usually flying over populated neighborhoods or down interstate highways. Very silent. Sometimes witnesses describe them as, football field size. Sometimes witnesses describe smaller than that. But there was a general characteristic theme of these objects. And if these, we initially thought at the very start that, the first 10 of these cases that we investigated is probably United States Special Access Program. But then we started thinking, these pilots are taking enormous risks by flying these experimental aircraft extremely low over populated areas. I mean, that's a real safety hazard. And, you've got 10 of these, so these pilots are drunk or they're impaired in some way to be taking these kinds of risks with very expensive experimental aircraft. So bottom line is we started moving away from the hypothesis. By the time we investigated 100 of these cases, we were starting to think that these were probably not special access programs. They were probably, quote unquote, UFOs. So, you know, fast forward to the OSAP program, one of the cases that we found in Georgia was, you know, this guy who was with his son and who was staying with a couple of friends in the backyard. And the dog started barking outside. He went outside to see what was going on. His eyes drifted upwards on this very large black silent triangle was parked above his home with no sound, but lights. He could see lights on the bottom of the object. So he tried to take a couple of cell phone photographs, but didn't work at all. So he went back inside and got his really high intensity flashlight, came out and then tried to light up the bottom of the object with the flashlight. But instantly the thing responded with this very intense blue beam of light that came from one of the corners of the triangle, and it and totally enveloped him with this blue light that was painful. You know, it was painful when it hit him, to the extent that he turned around to shield himself, and it was still painful, so he ran back into his house, and he looked at it from the shelter of his house through the window. The blue light stopped, and then this aircraft shortly thereafter took off in this sort of weird upward high velocity escape. But, you know, within a few hours, this guy started feeling kind of nauseous. By the time he woke up the following morning, he had this strong metallic taste in his mouth. He had, you know, he had sunburn on the back of his neck. His joints ached. He seemed to have like flu-like symptoms. And then over the next few days, several days, his hair started falling out from the area on the back of his head that had been exposed to this blue light. So over time, it became obvious that he had symptoms that sort of mimicked various symptoms of, you know, radiation, either electromagnetic or ionizing radiation. And the chances are, you know, the physiological symptoms that he encountered, the metallic taste in the mouth and all of that, are consistent with descriptions of radiation. But this triangular object was very, very similar, according to his description, to the triangular craft that NIDS had previously investigated, you know, down to the huge size. It was silent. It had, you know, lights on the corners of the triangle. So very similar object. But, you know, again, the triangular sightings have sort of receded somewhat now in terms of numbers of reports compared to what it was 20 years ago.
Yes, and yet that's still the number one most reported and most frequently reported variety of UAP that I've received reports of over the years. I'm also reminded of Dr. Richard Haynes' work with regard to the Korean War and sightings of UAP during that conflict. And there was one particular incident where he described similarly a kind of beam of light that comes out seemingly in response to soldiers shooting at a UAP. And this beam of light comes out, and then maybe hours or even a day later, people start suffering from these sort of, you know, flu-like symptoms and other kinds of things that could be consistent with radiation. So there are some consistencies between, well, I mean, clearly appear to be anomalous UAP, traditional flying saucers, right? And certain other aspects of the way that the triangular UAP behave. Dr. Kelleher, it has been wonderful talking with you, and I want to be judicious with your time here. I know you've got to go, but where can people find you and your work online going forward if they want to follow up and learn more about you?
Well, right now I'm with an organization called Bigelow Institute of Consciousness Studies. There's a website, but this is not a UFO organization. It's focused on focused on the study of consciousness, human consciousness, and whether human consciousness might survive bodily death. So it's not a UFO organization, but you know, the further we go along with this research, the more overlaps with the UFO topic and the consciousness aspects of the UFO topic we're finding. So eventually I would say that there will be some sort of a meeting down the road.
Well, let's certainly hope so. And again, thank you, Dr. Kelleher. It's been an excellent conversation. I sincerely appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Likewise.
All right. Take care, Colum. And of course, I'll have information about where he can be found online and, of course, where you can find his books and other projects online as well in the show notes. That's going to do it for this week's installment of the program. For X subscribers in the days ahead, as always, there will be some additional commentary from Dr. Kelleher and I about OSAP and various other things, which includes some of the overlap between his research and mine down there in Brazil. Yeah, lots more to discuss indeed. You can follow my work online at MicahHanks.com. You can email me info@MicahHanks.com or hit me up on Twitter @MicahHanks. And of course, my reporting and the entire team's reporting over there at thedebrief.org daily. All right, guys, until next time, as always, it is the Micah Hanks program. You guys stay strange out there.